Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. 41 years ago this week, President John F. Kennedy was shot and killed in Dallas, Texas. The assassination marked not only the end of a life, the life of the nation's leader, but also, to most Americans, the shattering of the dream of a new frontier that Kennedy had come to symbolize. In retrospect, journalist Godfrey Hodgson would later write, "People look back to Friday, November 22, 1963, as the end of a time of hope and the beginning of a time of troubles." Our guest this week, W.J. Rohrbach, author of Kennedy and the Promise of the 60s, explores the Kennedy era with Talking History's Lena Place. Jonathan Coopersmith will be with us to talk about a hallmark of the Kennedy administration, America's space policy, and how it fared under President George W. Bush. And Fiona Beattie will conclude the program with her recommended site of the week. But first, let's look at a few items of historical interest in the news on the topic of this week's program, John F. Kennedy. A group of historians and researchers have marked the 40th anniversary of the Warren Commission by deriding the government's official investigation into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In a report released by the group following their meeting in Washington this past September, the group said the Warren Commission report was so badly botched that most Americans have little confidence in its central conclusion, that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. "It was a complete and utter disaster," said Jim Lazar, head of the Assassination Archives and Research Center, "sowing only doubt, confusion, and distrust." And indeed, in the four decades since the report, Americans have grown increasingly suspicious of the Warren Commission's findings. A Gallup poll taken in 2001 found that 81% of those polled believed there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. Another Gallup poll taken last year found that 3/4 of Americans believed Oswald was part of a greater conspiracy. But some help in resolving the matter may be on the way. Another recent news item, this one in the New York Times, reports that scientists at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory have begun work on a digital scanning apparatus that they believe will be able to reproduce sound from the only known audio recording of the Kennedy assassination. The recording was made through an open microphone on a police motorcycle during Kennedy's motorcade into Dealey Plaza, where the president was shot. The sounds were captured on a dictaphone belt at police headquarters, but scientific analyses of the belt over the decades have proved anything but conclusive. As noted earlier, the Warren Commission decided that there were only 3 shots and that they were all fired by Lee Harvey Oswald from the Texas School Book Depository. But a House committee that investigated the shooting 15 years later and listened to the same recording concluded there were 4 shots, the 3 from the depository and a 4th from another location. This report supported a number of other explanations for the assassination, including the grassy knoll theory that argues for a 2nd shooter from another spot along the motorcade route. The National Archives hopes to settle the matter by using digital analysis to map the sounds from the dicta belt and remove extraneous noise like static and distant voices, thereby revealing the actual gunshots. The process is expected to take about 1 year. When we return, we look back at President John Kennedy and the promise of the 60s. This is Talking History. The 60s. The very phrase conjures up memories of flower children, the Vietnam War, civil rights, women's issues, and of course, John Kennedy. Talking History's Lena Place discusses Kennedy and the era he helped define with historian W.J. Rohrbach.
John F. Kennedy, a dashing figure who remains ever young in our images. The 60s, a time of often tumultuous change. Our guest today argues in his book, Kennedy and the Promise of the 60s, that the man and the times were uniquely suited to one another as President Kennedy presided over a period of transition unlike any other in our history. W.J. Rohrbach is a professor of history at the University of Washington, where he's taught since 1976. He is the author of a number of important books on American life and history, including The Alcoholic Republic, The Craft Apprentice, and Berkeley at War, the 1960s. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you very much, Lena.
In your book, you focus on really a very narrow slice of time, just the opening years of the decade of the 1960s, saying that they marked a transition period between the complacent 50s and the much more turbulent times that followed later in the 60s. What are some of the key elements that set this time apart from those years before and after?
I think the most important characteristic was optimism, a general sense of optimism. There was a kind of excitement about the idea of change. A change was in the air, and people were excited about that. There was a belief in possibilities. One thinks of, for example, the idea of the Peace Corps or going to the moon. These were new ideas, really new ideas. And in the backdrop of all this was the fact that the economy had been rising ever since 1945. So you had the post-war boom. Real incomes were about 50% higher than they had been at the end of the war. So people were feeling affluent, and therefore they were feeling good about themselves.
Many of the issues that would become so important later in the 60s, civil rights, family structure, peace, women's issue, have recurred throughout our American history. We can look at much earlier eras, such as the 1840s even, and find the same often very heated discussions occurring. Is there a climate that encourages those kinds of discussions, a climate of change, if you will, that fits in with your comments about a time of optimism and hope, certain preconditions that create these eras of dissent and change?
Well, I think the prosperity was absolutely essential. If people are worried about the economy and worried about jobs, they're not going to be concentrated on other kinds of things. So I think that that was absolutely essential. In addition, the World War II generation, now called the greatest generation that fought and won the war, by the period of 1960 was beginning to assume important positions in the society. So someone like Kennedy, who was an ordinary person in World War II, was now going to be president of the United States. And that made a difference, too. That generation had seen the world. Most Americans before World War II had not been outside of the United States. And so Americans had seen much of the world in the war and after the war, and so that internationalism, that globalism, also was an important change, and that causes Americans to have to rethink a lot of things about the United States, both internally, in the case of civil rights, and also in terms of foreign relations and how the United States fits into the rest of the world.
You suggest that Kennedy was very much a man of his generation, and that was one of the compelling aspects of his popularity, that even if he was not altogether typical in terms of his personal background, that he certainly represented an era, a time, and a set of experiences that the adult voting public could identify with.
Well, like all politicians, he tried to persuade people that he did, in fact, represent all of them and represent all of their views simultaneously, even, of course, when those views were contradictory. That's the nature of politicians, to do that. But there was a sense in which Kennedy did understand and was able to articulate this sense of optimism. One of the striking features about Kennedy is how optimistic he was. His speeches are full of optimism, and he's very upbeat. And that not only reflects the public mood of 1960 or 61, but it also, at the same time, encourages it. It causes people to be more optimistic. For example, James Meredith heard or watched Kennedy's inaugural address on television in January 1961, and he thought, just because there were a couple of words in that speech, which was almost entirely about the Cold War, but there were a couple of words about human rights at home. And Meredith immediately realized that this meant that if he applied to be the first black student at the University of Mississippi, Kennedy would actually stand up and do something about it and would protect him in his demand to be admitted to a school that otherwise he knew he would never be allowed to be admitted to. And so Meredith actually sent in his application just a few days later because he was inspired by Kennedy's speech.
You identify Kennedy, in your words, as the first celebrity president. Those kinds of presentations on television, radio, and elsewhere. A man who had a masterful command of the media. There was more to it, though, than that, right? He was more than a handsome man with a great deal of style. Early in your book, there's a rather poignant moment, actually, where he's reflecting on his opponent, Richard Nixon, commenting that Nixon had no sense of who he was and was constantly reinventing himself for a variety of audiences. The implication, of course, being that he, Kennedy, was a man of supreme self-confidence and knew exactly who he was. Is that really what was shining through in so much of the media applause for Kennedy, do you think?
the sense of self was very strong, and it was rooted in the Kennedy family's way of thinking about the world and interacting with the world as well. A lot of it, I think, is actually derived from Kennedy's father, the ambassador, Joseph Kennedy, who had a strong sense of public service and public mission as well. So there's a sense of mission in the Kennedy family, and that Kennedy himself is part of that. He was always ambivalent about politics, you know, and he went into politics because his older brother Joe, who was killed in the war, was the one who was supposed to go into politics and who really wanted to go into politics. And I think in some ways the ambiguity of his feelings about politics actually was transmitted to the public, and the public liked that. Here was someone who didn't have to be a politician. He was willing to do it because he thought it was a necessity that someone step up to the plate and accept the challenge. If you think about it, Kennedy's comment about Nixon really does get to the core of the Nixon problem, as we found in Watergate in 1974, mm-hmm. where Nixon didn't have a core at the core.
You say it again quite early in the book that politics was actually less important, clearly less important, you say, than the social and cultural upheaval of the time. Do you think that's changed? Can you develop that a little?
Well, I think if you compare today to the 1960s, I mean, first of all, this is not a very optimistic decade. Mm-hmm. The economic factors really are partly responsible for that. But in addition, in the end, the 60s is more about cultural change or social change than it is about political change. So perhaps some of the optimism of the early 60s was misplaced. That is, mm-hmm. people thought that the political system would be very responsive and so forth. And instead, the political system proved largely to be disappointing, so that by the end of the decade, Tom Wolfe referred to the 1970s as the me decade, when people turned inward and thought about themselves rather than about society. And so that was the ultimate legacy of the 60s. But I think it's interesting to look at this period in the early 60s and the way in which Kennedy both represented the society at that time, reflecting the feelings that people had, which is why he had the highest poll ratings in the history of polling while he was president. And yet at the same time, he's trying to push people forward. So it's an interesting relationship that he has with the public.
He's, of course, absolutely central to your discussion. And you present him really as both an architect of events, someone who's shaping what's happening, but also very much a symbol of the era. As we look back from now, our perspective of 40 years or more, do you think one of those roles is really more significant in evaluating his presidency than the other?
Well, I don't see him so much as an architect. I think societies are very complicated and composed of millions of people, or hundreds of millions, and a president really has limitations on what a president can do. So there's always a lot of hype about the president is doing this or the president is doing that. I mean, this is true for all presidents. Mm-hmm. So I don't think Kennedy's really an architect of the era, but I do think he encapsulated the feelings of the era, and I think he took advantage of that for himself politically, but he also perhaps was a catalyst for that. So I think catalyst would be a better word than architect. He's a catalyst for the optimism, and he pushes people who were already in an optimistic mood in 1958 or 59. They're coming out of the fog of the McCarthy era. In the early 60s, he pushes them forward, and he has this idea that we can do better, we can achieve more, we can be more successful. He defines success in large ways, going to the moon, for example, some of which are materialistic, creating a richer society, some of which have to do with compassion, creating a more just society. He's sympathetic to the civil rights movement, although at the beginning of his presidency, he barely understood what it was all about.
Was he sidetracked by the international crises that began to engulf much of the early presidency? Do you think that some of his optimism, some of his commitment to those causes lost their vigor as he had to address Cuba and beyond?
He was bedeviled by crises with the Soviet Union, and the Cold War was probably at its worst point during Kennedy's presidency. And the only thing you can say about it is that by the end, in the summer of 1963, when the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty is signed, which was the first treaty the United States ever was able to conclude with the Soviet Union, and he gives his famous Declaration of Interdependence speech at American University in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 1963, in which he warns that the world has to look for a more peaceful way of approaching global conflict, or otherwise nuclear annihilation is a real possibility. So the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was a traumatic event for the whole world and particularly for the President Kennedy, really, I think, kind of changed his thinking about the approaches that were going to be necessary in the future in order to manage the peace of the world.
Let's jump back a little bit to the 50s, because you provide such a nuanced and, I think, in many ways, very understanding portrait of what we've come to think of as the rather bland and uninteresting period of time, a decade that you suggest was sometimes referred to as the Great Barbecue. Now, before we have to go on, I really have to ask, you have kind of a sideline. Did President Eisenhower really grill his steaks on the roof of the White House?
Yes, he did. He couldn't. Well, you have to grill steaks outside, and he couldn't grill them inside the White House. He couldn't grill them on the front lawn because the people could look through the fence, and he couldn't grill them on the back lawn because they could look through the fence there, so the Secret Service wouldn't allow that. In fact, one time when he was grilling steaks on the roof of the White House, somebody passing by saw smoke pouring out of what they thought was the roof of the White House and called the fire department, and the D.C. fire department rushed over to put out the fire.
Wonderful
turned out
image.
To be only Eisenhower cooking steaks.
Doesn't show up in our history textbooks very often.
No.
Well, stakes aside, you go on then to describe what you call the dark undercurrents that were very apparent in the 50s, particularly culturally, the poets, the songwriters, and so forth. And as well, an acknowledgement by many, including the first barbecuer, President Eisenhower, of something that you refer to as the American problem. Can you tell us a bit about that problem and how, in some ways, it set the stage for a man like Kennedy?
Well, since the 50s was a great economic boom decade, materialism was the theme. And for people who had been starved in the Depression and had to sacrifice in World War II, the early part of the boom was a welcome thing. But by the mid and late 50s, there were increasing doubts about whether a society built on materialism was actually going to be a very successful society. The main problem with having more was that people then either wanted to have even more. I mean, it didn't have any sense of satisfaction. And so you had people like the beat poets, or indeed the folk singers, Joan Baez and Bob Dylan were beginning to emerge by the end of the 50s, who were questioning and challenging whether a society could really be constructed solely on the basis of materialism. And so in some ways, Kennedy's ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, is a challenge that challenges that materialism.
And how ironic, really, that Kennedy and his very glamorous wife, people of enormous wealth, who were certainly not barbecuing on the White House roof, somehow came to be such important messengers in that time, in a period where a non-materialistic view was beginning to take hold.
Even though Kennedy spent a lot of money, and of course Jackie spent even more, the fact is that Kennedy rarely thought about money. In fact, his father used to berate him about the fact that it was a good thing he had inherited a lot of money, because otherwise he would surely be bankrupt, because money was not a priority in his life. Jackie, I think, had a view that as the First Lady, she needed to set a tone and a standard for the whole of society, which she certainly did.
Very quickly, one last question. The promise. Was the promise fulfilled, or did it die with President Kennedy?
I think in many ways the assassination really did deflate people, and it just kind of crumbled the whole euphoric expectation. Certainly the 60s went on as a decade where people continued to have large goals, but there also were large conflicts, Vietnam and race riots and student riots and so forth. All of that really meant that the 60s as a decade became less and less optimistic. And by the end of the decade, you had a kind of sense of exhaustion, which is certainly not the basis of promise.
No. Well, thank you, Bill. We've been talking with William Rohrabaugh, author of Kennedy and the Promise of the 60s. This is Talking History.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking His blessing and His help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
When he took office in 1961, President John Kennedy committed the nation to a space program that would land a man on the moon by the end of the decade. More recently, President George W. Bush pledged to send astronauts back to the moon and, in time, to Mars. It's a dramatic and daring challenge. But is it a sound one? Jonathan Cooper Smith, professor of history at Texas A&M University, offers us his thoughts on the matter.
By deciding to send astronauts back to the moon and on to Mars, President George Bush has provided the first coherent goals for people in space since the Apollo project in the 1960s. But the president's goals threaten to hurt space exploration more than help it. Like so many Bush proposals, the goals are laudable, but their execution is short-sighted and probably harmful in the long run. The administration's new policy has two serious flaws. It proposes space exploration on the cheap, and it does not try to reduce the cost of reaching space from Earth. Over the next 5 years, NASA will spend $86 billion, less than the $87 billion the government is spending on the occupation of Iraq this year, only $1 billion more than previously budgeted. Sending a satellite into Earth orbit costs approximately $10,000 a pound. Until the cost of reaching orbit is greatly reduced, space will remain a frontier reachable only by a few. The Bush administration should commit itself to reducing the cost of reaching orbit to, say, $100 a pound. Such an effort would open space to human exploration and operations far more greatly and much quicker than sending a few astronauts to Mars. While the path not chosen of reducing launch costs will limit future development, the Bush administration's tendency to drink champagne on a beer budget has already harmed current research. The essential truth, ignored by his plan, is that space exploration cannot yet be done on the cheap. Historically, high costs and budget overruns are normal due to the challenging environment of space and difficulty in developing and deploying new complex technologies. The first American satellite program, Vanguard, was originally supposed to cost $10 million. Its ultimate cost, $110 million. The latest spy satellite system is already several billion dollars over cost. Why should these new projects be expected to be any different? Future costs of human flights to the Moon and Mars will undoubtedly increase greatly beyond initial projections, forcing NASA administrators to take risky shortcuts, ask for more funding, or cut elsewhere. Historically, that elsewhere has been robotic spacecraft. Scientists, regardless of their feelings about humans in space, justly worry that putting astronauts in orbit will occur at the expense of their unmanned spacecraft. These are the spacecraft, like Voyager, Pioneer, and Galileo, that have ranged from Mercury past the edge of the solar system to give us new perspectives on our planets, the solar system, and the universe. America is shortchanged in two ways by the Bush policy. First, by not focusing on reducing the cost of reaching orbit, the administration has forfeited the opportunity to truly increase access to space. Second, this new policy continues the Bush administration political strategy of promoting high-profile proposals that sound good and spend little initially, but delay the full cost for the future. Who wants to oppose tax cuts, better education for children, or exploring space? But the failure to fully fund public education and expanded space exploration means these programs cannot reach the lofty goals set for them, and that will be a loss for all of us.
You've been listening to Jonathan Cooper Smith, professor of the history of technology at Texas A&M University. Next up, Fiona Beebe's Site of the Week. You're listening to Talking History. Our topic for this week's program has been President John F. Kennedy. So it should come as no surprise that Talking History's Fiona Beatty is up next to tell you about what might be the best site to learn more about the man and his presidency, the Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum.
Forget the Red Sox. Next time you're in Boston, visit the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum. This imposing structure commands excellent views of the harbor and Boston. And once inside the museum, you'll step back in time, to the 60s, beginning with a street scene complete with a storefront of the Kennedy campaign headquarters. If you haven't had enough of electoral fever, you can watch the famous Nixon-Kennedy debates, or visit a recreation of the studio where Walter Cronkite covered the 1960 election. After that, you can sit and watch Kennedy's memorable inaugural address given January the 20th, 1961. But the literal passage in time is a reconstruction of the main White House corridor, where the visitor can stroll into anterooms and, of course, the famous Oval Office. You'll learn not only the glitz and dazzle of the Kennedys, but also about the political and historical crises faced by his administration. Following the metaphor of life and death, visitors leave the White House along a dark corridor, where news bulletins of JFK's assassination play on video monitors.
President Kennedy and Governor John Connally of Texas were both hit by a would-be assassin's bullets as they toured downtown Dallas in an open automobile a short while ago.
Tell us exactly what you saw, sir.
He was coming down the street, and my five-year-old boy and myself were by ourselves on the grass there on Palmer Street, and I asked Joe to wave to him, and Joe waved, and I waved, and the man...
That's all right, sir.
You went. As he was waving back, he was. The shot rang out, and he slumped down in the seat. And his wife reached up.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th president of the United States, is dead at the age of 46. Shot by an assassin as he drove through the streets of Dallas, Texas, less than an hour ago.
To plan your visit, or to find out more about the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library Museum, visit the museum's website at www.jfklibrary.org.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. As usual, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beatty, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu, or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.